Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies, who examines the results of the February 10th Israeli election and what it might mean for the future of Middle East peace negotiations. Steve Rendell of the media watch group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, who questions the even-handedness of U.S. media coverage of Venezuela's recent term limits referendum and its president, Hugo Chavez. And Joshua Kahn Russell of Rainforest Action Network, who talks about the largest environmentally focused civil disobedience action ever held in the U.S., set for March 2nd in Washington, D.C. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In a victory for environmentalists, China is blaming the rising level of birth defects on industrial pollution. According to the Los Angeles Times, recent comments by Zhang Fan, vice president of China's National Population and Family Planning Council, on the recent spike of birth defects is a significant admission of the cost of rapid industrial growth. On February 1st, Greenpeace China issued a statement saying Zhang's statement once again proved that coal burning is not only a climate killer, but one of the major health hazards in China. In 2007, China's Population and Family Planning Commission released a study showing birth defects in newborn babies increased 40% from 2001 through 2006, a period of explosive industrial growth in China. Last fall, the Center for Children's Environmental Health at Columbia University released a six-year study of the population in the central Chinese city of Chongqing. The study concluded that pollution from coal-fired power plants had harmed the weight, height, and motor skills of babies. Study co-author Tang Deliang added coal pollution has also altered the DNA in the newborn babies. The head of the Nobel Prize-winning Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, Rajendra Pachauri, created a storm of controversy when he suggested people eat less meat to reduce global warming. Cows and other livestock contribute 18% of all greenhouse gases, more than all modes of transportation combined. An editorial in the Pittsburgh Tribune Review blasted Pachauri by opining, "How convenient for him. He is a vegetarian." According to the American Prospect magazine, raising livestock for mass consumption causes environmental hazards from toxic animal waste in factory farms to energy-intensive processes of cultivating grain for farm animals. In the process, cows and other farm animals raised for their meat produce high levels of methane and nitrous oxide gases. Yet, the message of eating less meat is missing from the list of things major environmental groups say citizens can do to reduce climate change. The focus, instead, is on driving hybrid cars and using energy-efficient light bulbs. The Sierra Club lists 29 ways a citizen can fight global warming, but the group does not recommend eating less meat. The organization says it is not against eating meat, hunting, or ranching. Meanwhile, the Sierra Club has created several alliances with small hunters and ranchers in projects such as opposing big feedlots. The system of tax credits used to finance most affordable housing developments has collapsed along with the rest of the housing market, forcing affordable housing developers to seek new sources of funding. In Massachusetts, scores of projects have been put on hold, reports the Christian Science Monitor. This includes 270 Center Street in the Boston neighborhood of Jamaica Plain, where developers have halted all construction activity due to the withdrawal of $6 million in tax credits. The long-term tax credit program was started in 1986, offering investors and big banks like Citigroup and Wachovia a way to reduce future tax burdens in exchange for buying affordable housing tax credits. Now many big banks, as well as Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, are in serious financial trouble with little prospect for profits. Thus, they have no need to use the tax credits. The aim of the tax credit program was to find an alternative revenue base for building affordable housing once the federal government reduced funding for these housing programs. Now housing advocates are hoping for a boost from the Obama stimulus plan and new investor interest from energy and manufacturing companies, who may have a need to offset future profits. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruben Abreu.
Less than a month after Israel ended its bloody three-week military offensive in Gaza, killing an estimated 1,400 Palestinians, many of them civilians, Israelis went to the polls on February 10th to vote for members of the Knesset or parliament. Although it was not immediately clear which party would form the next government, it was evident that rightist parties were the big winners. The Kadima Party, under the leadership of Tzipi Livni, captured 28 out of 120 parliament seats, while Likud, the party of former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, won 27 seats. Beating the once-dominant Labor Party for third place was Avigdor Lieberman of the Israel Is Our Home Party with 15 seats. Lieberman, viewed by many as a racist, anti-Arab extremist, with his calls for Israeli Arabs to take a loyalty oath to remain citizens, could be the kingmaker in forming the next government. With the numbers of right-wing seats now in parliament, Netanyahu is viewed as having the best chance of winning the necessary support to become Israel's next prime minister. While saying that he would agree to engaging in negotiations with Palestinians, the hardline Likud leader shows his hawkish side when declaring that he would never return the occupied Golan Heights to Syria. Tzipi Livni, one of the architects of the Gaza assault, has stated that the Jewish state has no option but to continue with internationally backed peace talks with the Palestinians. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies, who examines the results of the February 10th Israeli election, the unvarnished positions of the major parties, and what it might mean for the future of Middle East peace negotiations.
Well, the most important phenomenon that we see in this set of elections was a powerful and dramatic shift to the right. Israeli public opinion was already quite far to the right and was moving further to the right. But this was a consolidation of a number of strands of right-wing thought, including several different versions, the version led by Netanyahu that focuses on control of land, the version led by the fascist right, and I use that term quite advisedly, the racist and fascist right tendency of Avigdor Lieberman, the leader of the Israel Is Our Home party, who focuses on separation, getting Arabs out of Israel, even if it means giving up territory to do so. So there's somewhat different versions of this right-wing tendency. But we should also not forget that the Kadima party itself, the so-called centrist party, which beat out the mainstream right-wing party, Likud, by one seat, the Kadima party is itself a very right-wing party. Its founder was the former head of Likud, the general Ariel Sharon, who still lies in a coma, and who has long been known as the Butcher of Beirut for his role in the Sabra Shatila massacre, for his role in the Lebanon invasion of 1982. I think the body politic of Israel is the only place in the world where you could have a party as right-wing as the party of General Sharon, which, without shifting a single tenet of their beliefs, somehow quickly becomes a centrist party overnight because public opinion moves so far and so fast to the right that it bypasses the mainstream right wing.
Phyllis, what's your view on differences, if any, between these two major parties, Likud and Kadima, when it comes to attitudes towards settlements in the West Bank, the blockade of Gaza, and other related issues?
The difference is you have somebody like Tzipi Livni who campaigned on the basis of, you should vote for me because I will be Barack Obama's best friend, versus Bibi Netanyahu, who says, you should vote for me because I believe that we should use only military and not negotiating tactics with the Arabs, and I don't really care what the Americans think. Now, if you look at that, it sounds like they're very different. But what's not different is, did they both support the assault on Gaza? Answer, yes. Livni was the foreign minister and was crucially involved in it. Netanyahu supported it. His only criticism was they pulled out too fast. Do they both support settlements on the ground? Well, in terms of what do they do on the ground, yes, the answer is they both support settlements on the ground. Tzipi Livni allows the settlements to go forward, allowed during just this last year and the 1 year since the Annapolis conference that was supposedly a new lease on life to the negotiating process. We have seen a 30% increase in settlement construction throughout the West Bank. Now, she doesn't say, I support settlements. She actually says the opposite. She says, I support negotiations. But That doesn't mean anything when she allows the settlement expansion to go forward. Bibi Netanyahu, on the other hand, says, I support settlement expansion. So what you have is the difference between an honest representative of the right wing and a somewhat disingenuous representative of the right wing who claims that they support a different position, but in fact support the same settlement expansion, militarization of policy, etc.
Phyllis, if the right wing takes power under Bibi Netanyahu, any pretense of flexibility and pragmatism and giving an ounce of importance to peace negotiations just may very well be off the table, allowing Barack Obama, if he's so inclined, to really push Israel towards negotiations, if that's possible. But what's your view here?
I think once in office, the question will be, does he try for a so-called government of national unity, which will be a recipe for absolute paralysis and will lead to no negotiations because there can't be any agreement in a government like that? Or will it be a government of the right, which will officially take the position that we should not have negotiations? So I think either way, with a Netanyahu-led government, we're not going to see real negotiations. The issue, I think, Scott, is not so much whether Barack Obama is predisposed to that approach or not, although that's an important factor. The most important factor is whether the movement in this country that supports Palestinian rights, that supports human rights, that supports equality, that wants a change in U.S. policy away from support for occupation and towards support for equality and an end to occupation, whether we will work hard enough to convince Barack Obama that that's the politically safest position for him to take, that despite the rhetoric of the pro-occupation forces that operate so heavily in Washington, AIPAC and the Council of Presidents and Christians United for Israel and all the others, that the safest position for him that reflects the best views of his own base will be to end military aid to Israel, pressure Israel to lift the siege of Gaza, and stop providing a veto as a way to prevent Israel from being held accountable for its war crimes in the United Nations.
That was Phyllis Bennis, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. Her books include Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict, a primer. Read her article, Israeli Elections and the Rise of the Right, online at fpif.org. Venezuela's President Hugo Chavez won an important electoral victory on February 15th when voters passed a referendum abolishing term limits for all offices in the oil-rich nation, including the presidency. Chavez, in power since 1998, has vowed to extend and consolidate his self-described socialist Bolivarian revolution if he should win re-election in 2013, the year his current term in office expires. Often bluntly critical of President Bush and Washington's policies toward Latin America, Chavez has infuriated U.S. power brokers by using his country's oil resources to redistribute wealth to Venezuela's poor, nationalizing American-owned corporations, and making alliances with U.S. adversaries. The U.S. media often parrots the government's demonization of Chavez, branding him an egomaniacal demagogue and dictator, even as the White House backed an unsuccessful military coup against the democratically elected leader in 2002. While the negative media coverage of Chavez is predictable, it decidedly is not even-handed, as noted in a recent study of American newspaper editorials about Venezuela as compared to neighboring Colombia, a staunch U.S. ally. In a new report titled Human Rights Coverage Serving Washington's Needs, the group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, or FAIR, found editors downplaying Colombia's abuses and amplifying Venezuela's. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Steve Rendell, senior analyst with FAIR, who summarizes the report, observing that U.S. newspapers seem more interested in reinforcing official U.S. policy toward the region than in genuinely supporting the rights of Colombians and Venezuelans.
Well, as we came into the referendum, you saw a lot of attention to the fact that Chavez was trying to lift or abolish term limits. You saw some references to him as attempting to make himself president for life. Now, of course, that's a lie. He was merely trying to arrange so that a president could run every 6 years for an indefinite number of terms. a situation that, by the way, we had in this country until Franklin Roosevelt, and nobody said that U.S. presidents were assaulting democracy, which is the way a lot of reporting and commentary frames Chavez's moves. But, you know, there's a pretty easy little experiment one can do, and that is try to find similar situations and see how they were reported on. And in fact, anybody who knows Colombia's recent history knows that the current president there, Alvaro Uribe, was pressing to extend term limits for himself in Colombia in 2004. And he succeeded in getting the Colombia Congress to pass by one vote an amendment to the Constitution to allow him to seek a second term. He is currently in the process of trying to change it again to allow him to seek a third term. We do not hear relentlessly in the U.S. press about Uribe being anti-democracy or his efforts being an assault on democracy. In fact, we don't even hear about his efforts. And this is in spite of another feature of his efforts that make it far more newsworthy. That one vote that he won by back in 2004, that was secured through bribery by Uribe's aide. It was a huge story in Colombia. The woman, the member of Congress who accepted some in-kind donations and some promises of jobs in return for her vote, is serving 47 months under house arrest today. I think another person is in prison. I don't know that person's name or exactly what their role is, but I have read about them. Now, get this straight. Uribe's efforts to extend his term limits include bribery. Bribery in the supposed democratic system of Colombia, and he comes off in the U.S. press as the U.S.'s favorite Democrat in the area, certainly the largest recipient of U.S. aid in the hemisphere. But Chavez, who holds a free and fair, that's what they're calling it so far, a free and fair public vote, a referendum on the issue of term limits and wins, is called anti-democratic. So what you see here, and this gets back to the subject of our study, what you see here is just an absolute gobsmacking double standard. There's no other way to put it.
Now, you looked at newspaper stories over a 10-year period and specifically focusing on Venezuela's human rights record versus Colombia's. Colombia, of course, engaged in a decades-long civil war with the FARC and other guerrilla groups. And there's been, you know, numerous human rights abuses. Tens of thousands have been killed, many civilians, journalists have been targeted, union activists have been massacred. But in Venezuela, there isn't that kind of civil conflict going on. And the human rights situation is certainly markedly better, of course, than what we see in Colombia. But your study found what?
We looked actually at editorials in four major papers, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, and the Miami Herald. We chose the Herald because they do so much coverage and have so much commentary of Latin America. So those four papers, we looked over a 10-year period from 1998 through 2007. We looked at every editorial that addressed the human rights situations in either Venezuela or Colombia. Whatever Venezuela's faults are, they do not compare to the dismal, the gruesome situation in Colombia. So what we thought is if these editors at these four big dailies were trying to do the job of journalism, and that is, in this case, as editors, through commentary, trying to educate their readers about the situation in Venezuela and Colombia, and maybe to some degree trying to help that situation by shining a light on the human rights problems, if they were actually trying to do an even-handed job, they would actually portray Colombia as being a far grimmer place as far as human rights than Venezuela. But that's not what we found. We found upwards of 90% of their editorials about Venezuela cast Venezuela in a negative light. A little less than 10% of those same editorials about Venezuela were mixed. In other words, they said good things and bad things about human rights in Venezuela. Colombia was a different story. With Colombia, a majority of the editorials that addressed human rights in Colombia gave Colombia either a positive or a mixed report. And something I think in the neighborhood of 35 or 40% of the stories were solely or only negative. So if you came in from outer space, Scott, and all you knew about Colombia and Venezuela's human rights records was what you read in these four papers' editorial pages, you would think Colombia was a safer place than Venezuela. So in other words, these editors have basically turned the human rights situation in those two countries on their head. And the question really is why? Why do they do that?
That was Steve Rendell, senior analyst with Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. FAIR's report, Human Rights Coverage Serving Washington's Needs, can be read online at fair.org or call their office at area code 212-633-6700. On March 2nd, green organizers expect thousands of people to descend on Washington, D.C. for the largest environmentally focused civil disobedience action ever held in the U.S. The activists will focus on the partially coal-fired plant that powers a Capitol building and call for an urgent and immediate shift to renewable energy to reduce the impact of global warming. The day is timed to coincide with PowerShift 09, an energy conference which is expected to bring 10,000, mostly young activists, to the Capitol to push for bold climate and clean energy policies. The civil disobedience, called Capitol Climate Action, is being organized by a coalition of 70 groups. The organizers believe that with a new administration and a new Congress, there is now a unique window of opportunity to affect policy. They hope that this action will be a rallying cry for a clean energy economy to protect both public health and the planet's fragile climate. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Joshua Kahn Russell, grassroots actions manager at Rainforest Action Network and one of the principal organizers of the protest. He discusses the rationale for the action and the leadership role young people are now taking on the issue of climate change.
The planet itself is powered by a number of things, including coal, that directly powers our Congress, and we really are using this as a flashpoint and symbol for the stranglehold that coal has over our economy and the health of our communities and our futures. You know, our goals and demands are not around this specific plant, but rather to use this as an iconic symbol to send a much larger message around a clean energy economy, around creating equitable, binding energy and climate policy, around repowering our nation. Part of the reason that actually mixed coal is a great example is that it's actually really easy to switch over this plant. All it is an issue of political will. They could do it with a stroke of a pen. There's nothing else standing in the way of that. And that's how we see a lot of the roadblocks to moving forward with a clear climate policy that's going to revitalize our economy in this country is that it's an issue of political will. And so part of the goals of this action are to do a really strong showing of power, to express that urgency, to build that political momentum and will and leverage.
I'm aware that coal provides at least 40% of the electricity in this country, and it's by far the dirtiest form of energy. So what are your demands? Do you want the U.S. to get off coal or off all fossil fuels?
With this action, we're trying to give leverage and political power to a wide range of folks demanding a repowering of our nation. So it's that broad. At the same time, we're part of a much larger movement that has really specific policy asks, and a lot of those are around a coal moratorium. A lot of those are around creating 5 million green jobs that have pathways out of poverty, carbon tax with permits auctioned off. So there's a wide range of policy asks that are coming out of this movement that we're a part of, and we see our role as really bearing witness to an evil and standing in the tradition of the civil rights and labor movements of this country and putting ourselves on the line to offer that sense of moral urgency to back that.
Joshua Kahn Russell. Nuclear power in the generation of it does not contribute to global warming, though of course it has its own problems. Does the coalition have a position on nuclear energy?
So the coalition of 70 groups, we really believe that a shift to a low-carbon, clean energy economy should focus on improving the health and well-being of low- and moderate-income people who suffer disproportionately from cancer, asthma, and other respiratory ailments. And, you know, a lot of these sort of immediate health effects of our pollution-based economy, what that means for me is that we can't have, you know, uranium mining for nuclear power plants on native reservations. We have to look at the entire life cycle of coal, including, you know, mountaintop removal mining and the folks who are stuck in neighborhoods right next to coal-fired power plants. We really do want to question, you know, some of the so-called solutions that are being put forward around clean coal and nuclear, and really looking for, you know, genuine clean alternatives around wind and solar.
Do you think the clean energy sources you mentioned will be enough to stave off catastrophic climate change? Do you think it's just a matter of political will?
Well, it's not exclusively political will. Barack Obama's call for change is around a movement that continues well past Election Day and pushes for change in all sectors of our society and really seeing change being brought to Washington coming from the bottom up. So we're pushing Congress to take stronger, bolder action, and we're also pushing ourselves to do that. Many of us are involved in organizing politically and writing and testifying and organizing our communities on a day-to-day basis. The only hope for getting our atmosphere back to a safe level is below 350 parts per million, and that lies in stopping the use of coal to generate electricity.
You, along with many, many other young people, have really taken up the issue of climate change. Do you feel your elders, those who are in positions of decision-making, aren't really doing what they should be doing?
One of the things that I feel really deeply on a personal level, but also on a political level, is just seeing young folks stand up to reclaim our future, that a lot of the people who are in official positions of power are making decisions that are not going to affect them nearly as much as it's going to affect us. That, you know, climate change is a fact of the present. It's affecting us now. But it's also a question of deep, deep, deep impacts in the future. And it's our future that's at stake on the chopping block. And, you know, a lot of people in my generation are really seeing that and really standing up and using this not only a call to action around climate, but as a way of rethinking the way we do business in a lot of aspects of our society and rethinking, you know, how this crisis has come about and how we can solve it in a deep and integrative way. And the leadership of young people on this issue is outstanding. And I think it's going to continue to be, and we're going to see that, you know, 2 weeks from now at the Capitol.
That was Joshua Kahn Russell, organizer of the March 2nd Capitol Climate Action. For more information and details on how to participate at various levels, visit the group's website at capitalclimateaction.org. Or call Rainforest Action Network at area code 415-398-4404. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Ruben Abreu, Chris Ferriero, Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.